Welcome to Farcast. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I'm Michael Farr. Thank you so much for joining us again this week on the Farcast. What a terrific show. Harry Jennings is lined up for you tonight. We have some wonderful, wonderful guests. As we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world, we're going to lead off with my friend Jim Murio from the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. You've seen him on CNBC. He's just one of the smartest guys we get to talk to every week. We like your notes and feedback that you like him too. Also, actually, as I'm sure you figured out from the Farcast, one of the nicest fellows we talked to. Figure out what's going on Wall Street. Then Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress will be with us to talk about what is God's name is going on with tariffs and Brexit and the president having dinner with the Queen. And has anybody remembered that we were still negotiating with China? Well, if you do remember, Les Munson in segment three will join us, a Washington insider, as we analyze exactly how all of this is going to play with China, with Mexico, and indeed with a transfer of power in Great Britain, and how a new prime minister may or may not handle this issue of Brexit. But before we get to my friend Jim Murio, remember that on the Farcast, we believe that money is hard to make. We believe that old-fashioned research, hard work, discipline, and patience are the keys to successful investing. And finally, that emotion is the foe of the long-term investor. So if you're feeling fearful, as you may have been yesterday, or ebullient, as you may be feeling today, after the damn stock market just went up over 500 points and NASDAQ is up almost 200 points. It's absolutely remarkable, this volatility. If you're feeling something very strongly, stop feeling and start looking at your numbers and get some advice if you need it. Emotion will take you down the wrong path. My friend Jim Murio is Managing Director of TJM Institutional Services. He's been on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange since, you're not going to believe it, 1987, when we were both 12 years old. He is the CNBC go-to contributor. Welcome back to the Farcast, Jim.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man. Did you notice that today, Jim, that stocks were up?
They were, yeah. I think I did see that somewhere, I believe.
And so tell me, what do you think was going on?
I think that things are good again, it seems, doesn't it?
Well, did you notice yesterday they were down?
Yeah, but I don't think things were as good yesterday, clearly. No, and I guess, you know, and I say
that
jokingly.
See, it's that kind of keen analysis we count on from you, Murio.
Yeah, that's what you got. Write that down, everybody.
That's right. Thank you for listening to the Farcast, ladies and gentlemen. Jesus. God.
This story that came out today about the Fed and about the Fed having our back and saying everything's fine, we will you know, adjust policy, whatever. This isn't just today's story. This is a 10-year story. In my opinion, whether or not you agree with it or don't, spoiler, I don't agree with the policy. It's great for risk asset prices, and they care about risk asset prices. So the comments I heard today about what they're going to bend over backwards and do whatever they can to keep this expansion going, that amazes me. But I think it also means I'm supposed to be long stocks.
Well, okay. It amazed me. I think it does mean you're supposed to be long stocks, but I've got to tell you, it was echoes of Mario Draghi saying, you know, 2 years ago, saying, you know, we're going to do whatever it takes over here in the EU to keep this thing going. I mean, it feels like Powell just said the same thing, and I think it felt like he said it in response to policy risk over this Mexico tariff kind of a, you know, downfall the day before.
Is that perspective?
Huh?
You know, we have, I mean, the Fed is supposed to look out over the landscape, and part of that is, you know, federal government policy, and then adjust accordingly. But this is not a policy that's even real yet. This is something that's just our threats and barbs and stones thrown. We've seen nothing, no documentation on it. I don't believe it's even real. I think it's just words. I'm curious to hear what you think about it, the reality of it.
I mean, let's just be clear as to what Jim Murio just said. I said, so Farr says the Fed's responding to policy risk. Murio says it's not even a policy yet. I mean, we're just talking about a policy.
This baffles me. This is just something that blows me away. But, you know, again, my job is to look at what they say and do and try to make money from it. And, you know, to me, I think that's being in risk assets still.
And kind of what you're saying, Jim, is it doesn't really mean you and I may indeed disagree with the Fed's position. And I'm going to tell you, I disagree with the Fed coming out and responding like this. It seems too Pavlovian to me. But, you know, the bell has been rung and they're going to start to drool. Stop it, Fed. You're supposed to be thoughtful and more data dependent than just the threat. But if, in fact, you know, they are going to do it, whether I agree with it, it doesn't matter. Whether Uriel even agrees with it, doesn't matter. They're going to have the stock markets back. You better own some stocks. Is that the message?
That's what I believe to be the message. And I think, though, you know, I like to blend technical with fundamental, too. And right now, today that we got over that 2,800 level in the S&P, that's very, very important. We have to keep that level for a few days because there's always, when you hit big technical levels, there's always it's prone to some head fakes on occasion. So you need it for a couple of days. If I see some follow through tomorrow, that will go a long way in convincing me that we're headed higher. For the long-term investor, as we said a lot of times before, you know, we've lived through two things. You know, the tech stock boom and bust and yes. The real estate boom and bust and yes. The subsequent stock market things that happen, that every time we see a little weakness, everyone sits in their chair and says, well, is this going to be the next big thing? I don't think it's going to be the next big thing. I think, you know, you talked about the overactive Fed. You know, prior to, let's say, 30, 40 years ago, recessions used to come, you know, every 2 to 4 years.
Yes.
Now, since 1992, we've only had two recessions. Because the Fed squashed them, all central banks come out and squash them at every turn. So what they do is just coil the spring tighter and tighter. So when they come, they explode like the two we've seen in the last 25 years. I think that's what we're in now, but I don't think the spring is ready to explode.
Well, it leads to more of this insanity like modern monetary theory where, when you have all these central banks who are trying to absolutely kill any possibility of recession, you have to throw money at the damn problem, and to throw money at it, you create an enormous amount of debt. And so the debt keeps going up, and they want to tell us that the debt doesn't matter as long as they keep interest rates low enough, and all of that works perfectly well until it doesn't.
Of course, and that's so funny is that they come up with these, and I know modern monetary theory is not totally brand new, but they trot it out again to try to like explain in the rears of things that we're kind of already doing. And it is so completely irresponsible. And even the people that, you know, the eloquent faces they put on it, like I think her name's Stephanie Shelton from Stony Brook, whatever her name is. She's the queen of MMT now. And she's eloquent, and she sounds like she knows what she's talking about. And guess what? She doesn't know what she's talking about.
You know, my father had a yellow, navy blue, green with streaks of pink Madras jacket that he would trot out about every 5 years just to see if everybody would scream and say, yeah, that's still as ugly as we told you it was 5 years ago.
I bet it looks sharp. That sounds like my style. I would borrow that.
You know, it actually looked like one of those things straight out of Caddyshack. I mean, it looked like something Judge Smales should be wearing. It didn't suit Dad very well. By the way, everybody I know, pretty much, let me change that. Everybody I like can quote at least half a Caddyshack at the drop of a hat. All right. I'm wasting Uriel precious time. So, Jim, when we look at where we are broadly with the economy, the economy's in decent shape, you and I have discussed before, but the numbers, growth numbers, are slowing as you look into the fall and into 2020. Indeed, if we saw these Mexican tariffs, not hard to envision a recession as early as the first quarter of 2020, at least in my opinion, if you start taxing everything out of Mexico. But so if we are slowing anyway economically, what do you see? Can we get around all of these tariffs? I mean, does a resolution with China before the election even matter? I've heard some people say that there's no way they're going to come up with any deal with China prior to the election.
I don't know. I do know what I think, and that this is all tremendous theater. And of course, in my opinion, they're going to get a resolution to all these different trade disputes before, one, the stock market goes too much lower, or the recession begins, or the election starts. There's just no possible way. No, this administration doesn't want to be the butt of jokes, and they don't want to be the goat if this kind of things happen. So I don't think there's any chance. Personally, and again, I guarantee nothing. I'm just going to trade based on this belief. I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell that things won't get resolved either relatively quickly, or if things start to happen bad to the economy or the stock market, you're going to see just, okay, you know, China give us one little concession and Donald Trump claiming this enormous victory, and then everything will be done.
You know Jack Barugian?
Yo, sure.
Yeah, old friend of both of ours, right? So Jack's on the Farcast last week. Jack says the greatest risk to investors over the course of the next quarter will be being not invested. Jack says he thinks this thing's coiled. I tend to believe that, too.
I need a few things to prove it to me, but I'm kind of with him.
I mean, he says that this is a coiled spring for investors that's ready to go, and that it's got, you know, all of the support in place from the Fed and everywhere else, and not to mention a president who wants a higher stock market. Why wouldn't you own this thing, was a lot of what Barugian told us last week. I mean, and if he says that, and even and you say, okay, I can sort of see that you're not, it didn't sound like you're 100% with it, but gently inclined that way. What do you tell Fred and Ethel they should own, Jim? I mean, they're looking at a market that's not that cheap today.
I can only tell them the things that I like to own. And what I like to own, the broad market. And what I'm also looking at, too, is crude oil came off a lot down to 52. And it's been trading kind of as a risk asset. And I believe that if the stock market rallies, that crude and the crude names will rally as well. They also happen to pay a dividend, which juxtaposed against a pretty low interest rate starts to look pretty good too. So I'm going to personally start to look at things in the energy names that pay dividends that are correlated to the price of crude and then the market overall. I can't decide if I'm going to dip back into tech yet, because it seems to be, you know, the whipping boy kind of right now, but I'm going to look for a basing pattern of that as well.
Greg Valliere says that there's no chance in hell that they actually impose meaningful sanctions anywhere in the next 2 years. They may get some wrist slaps, but basically most every one of these tech companies under fire has such huge cash reserves that it can't be a material issue, and it's just kind of a political gamesmanship. Does that sound right to you? I mean,
I think so, but I think there's something missing from that analysis too, is that if selling really starts to happen, you know, selling begets selling on its own,
yes,
regardless of what the real story is, and that's one thing I worry about, but independent of that, I agree 100%.
Can't believe that we're out of time here. I'm going to ask you one more question, because I just, anytime I get to talk to Uriel, it's a good time.
Hope it's about Caddyshack, but go.
I wish it were about Caddyshack. give us some advice on how you handle the volatility of the last 2 days. I mean, the NASDAQ got creamed yesterday. It's rocking up today. This, as you start looking at prices, as you were looking at prices yesterday and hearing things fall apart and then looking at them rebound today, how do you keep your wits about you? How do you keep the center board in the water and keep your boat on course for other investors?
You know, you're setting up for my favorite trading theory that I adhere to all the time, which is the George Costanza theory, which I don't know if you remember the episode when he was explaining his fake job as a stock trader.
Yes.
And he says, when everything in my head says I'm supposed to sell it, I buy it. And that's really what I am supposed to do. And that's how I've made a bit of money over the years, is when it just things look like they're going to hell. And of course, I look at it on a technical basis, too, when it comes into some support. And yesterday it did come into a little bit of support. But that's basically it, is you don't trust your emotions, because your emotions are usually tied in with everyone else's. And guess what? They're usually wrong.
Long hitter, the llama. Yep. Long hitter. No.
Was big hitter.
Big hitter. Was going to stiff me, but no. Enlightenment. If you want to listen to something, what you need? Perfect knowledge. Enlightenment. That was what the llama promised. That's what you get from Jim Urio. Just either listen to the Farcast or watch Caddyshack. It's pretty much the same thing, you know?
Amen.
Caddyshack for Markets. Jim Urio, thank you so much for being with us again this week. We always learn so much, and it's always so much fun to get to talk to you. Thank you.
All right. See you guys. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be back with my friend, the great Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress when we come back on the Farcast.
You're listening to Farcast.
Every week, the Farcast brings you lively discussion and insights to bring you a deeper understanding of the world, the economy, and the markets. For a quick snapshot of the market's headlines, commodities, and futures, you can subscribe to our daily podcast, the Farcast 3-Minute Morning Brief. Every morning before the markets open, we bring you a snapshot in the time it takes to brew a pot of coffee. And now, back to Michael Farr and the Farcast.
Now more with Michael Farr and the Farcast.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. Terrific segment there with my friend Jim Murio. You know, when we need to know really what's going through the middle of the markets and the heartbeat of the country, Jim Murio from the floor of the Chicago Exchange, I always learn so much when I talk with Jim. And he always seems to find a silver lining for us each week. I always appreciate that. Now, what a week we've had in politics. And remember, on the Farcast, we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. And as we talk about Washington, our senior political analyst, Dan Mahaffey, my very good friend from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and I have really not struggled to find things to talk about for our brief segment every week. This week has proven even more fruitful than anybody I think either would have expected. A week ago, Dan, the president not only got over and, you know, was dining with the Queen of England and hanging out with Prince Charles, but also did something that I've never actually seen a president do before. Based on his interpretation of the law, he issued an emergency edict that he would issue and begin tariffs in the next couple of weeks on Mexico, starting at 5%, escalating in by October to 25% on everything that comes out of Mexico, because the Mexican government is not doing enough to stop immigration through Mexico and illegal immigration into this country. So in case you were bored as Washington watchers, and I can't believe you were, the president and the administration giving us a lot more to talk about this week. Dan, welcome back to the Farcast. Please give us your fabulous interpretation of what we've seen this week and what we should be paying attention to.
Well, I think no matter what, the Chinese are getting us with that curse of may you live an interesting time.
No question about it.
We're looking at this and what can only be described as the what we might call the tariff tantrum.
Yes,
where the president continues to think that the southern border immigration issues, along with trade to a certain extent, that is really what propelled him to victory, and that no matter what the political headwinds or establishment resistance, he's got to go ahead and push hard on those issues. That's the sense he gets. You have advisors like Stephen Miller, who are very influential on immigration, clearly outranking and outpunching the trade advisors, as well as congressional leadership. We were talking about this last week, where Congress was trying to tell the president only one trade war at a time, and then he turns around and threatens Mexico with this.
So, okay, so Dan, let's try and break down a little bit about what's happening. Was there any issue? Was there anything in the news to suggest that we needed to do something about illegal immigration through Mexico right now? Was there any trigger there?
Well, okay, we're seeing greater numbers of arrests at the border, large numbers of immigrants coming from Central America through Mexico, overwhelming a lot of the infrastructure that we have for immigrant and detention, things like that. But pushing these two economies to the brink of a true economic conflict, that is something you don't really see in the sense of, okay, how do we deal with a humanitarian law enforcement issue? Tying that to trade is something that we have not seen previous presidents do. I think Trump sees himself as being innovative and thinking outside the box on this. But it really does endanger his economic record when you think about all the supply chain, the agricultural ties, everything that exists in this integrated North American market that includes Mexico.
At 3:20 this afternoon, the Washington Post published a story that said GOP lawmakers warn the White House they will try to block Trump's Mexico tariffs. And the article went on to say that, indeed, not only do they have the votes to vote down the tariffs, they have the votes to override a veto. What does it mean for the Republicans? If you can tell our listeners, what does it take for a party in the Senate, the president's own party, to coalesce in such a way about any issue to object, and to for his own party to go back and say, and we have the votes to override your veto? What does that mean, regardless of the topic? What does it take for that to happen?
Well, what you have, first of all, is, and I remember saying this in the past, the reason Donald Trump didn't need a dog for a pet in the White House is because he had the Republican Party. But what you have now is this sense, I think, that with no clear resolution for the trade war with China really affecting our agriculture industry. You think of rural America, the Republican heartland, when you have it politically, they're feeling the pinch from that trade war. You also have certainly what we've seen with the weather in huge parts of middle America, flooding, tornadoes, et cetera, that have really delayed. So farmers who for a long time were kind of saying, look, we'll stick with the president. We want to see where this goes. I think a lot of those senators in the Republican caucus are looking at what they're hearing from home right now. And I think that patience of rural America is running out and really could not withstand another trade conflict with Mexico that's going to really affect agriculture as well as the other manufacturing industries, the sort of blue collar base that now the Republicans see as their main path to electoral
You make this sound like a very common sense move, Dan. Just the Republicans showing some common sense here. We don't really care about the politics of this. We care about the guts of the issue, or are they really concerned about the, I guess, the politics with the farmers and the implications economically? It just seems to me that you don't hear about when the control of the Senate is the same as the party control of the Senate, same as the party control of the White House, the executive branch. You don't hear this happening very often, do you, or am I wrong?
No, you don't hear it very often, although senators do have a little more flexibility. Their six-year terms do largely insulate them from the president when they can. That's why I think it's interesting to see, you know, Joni Ernst, who's from Iowa and is up for re-election in 2020. She's been particularly vocal about opposing these tariffs. So there's a sense that this is definitely part of the economic and political calculus when you look at your prospects for re-election in 2020. Still beyond that, I think the question becomes, look, we understand the need for action on trade with China, that this is a country that has really is a contretemps with our political values, our way of life, all of those things that, you know, we see in opposition with the Chinese on issues of technology. I think Congress understands that and can get behind it and was becoming very supportive of the president. But then this action on Mexico, really, when they're giving you advice to focus on one trade war at a time, this comes off as completely out of, you know, sort of out of his own whim. And the Republicans want to stand back on and push back on that.
OK, Dan, I have a theory. Now, I should hesitate and not just share my theories like this when people might actually listen to them. But here's the theory. The theory is, you know, I've been reading from my different sources who do follow Capitol Hill very closely, that they thought come end of year, this is several weeks ago, that Jay Powell was really going to come under fire in the fall because given the stall with the Chinese, the president really would see the economy slowing and would focus both double barrels on Jay Powell and indeed might fire him by year end in order to get a more accommodative Fed with which to approach his 2020 reelection. As you look at what's just happened, the economy was slowing, and economic forecasts from most major economists and Wall Street firms, I mean really across the board, have come down significantly for GDP. GDP growth has fallen below 2% for the last half of 2019 and certainly into 2020. So GDP growth estimates have really come down significantly. The economy is slowing as largely as a result of these tariffs that have been imposed in the unresolved trade situation with China. Add on to that, potential new tariffs with Mexico, our third largest trading partner in the U.S. And I'm going to tell you the chances for a recession really skyrocket into the first quarter of 2020. Heretofore, we thought there wasn't even one in sight for the next 2 years. These sorts of tariffs could slow growth sufficient to put us in a recession in 2020. So here's the conspiracy theory from far. The president says, I'm not going to have to fight Powell. I can just make this data-dependent Fed, have such poor data by the very threat or imposition of these tariffs that the economy's slowing to the point in September, October, November, December, that the Fed will have to ease those cuts because based on the data they will see, they indeed will be obliged to do it. And then come maybe, April of 2020, the president backs off on these tariffs. The economy goes rip-roaring, rip-snorting forward from April all the way on, at least through August or September, when most people have made up their minds. And that's his best shot to re-election. Am I out of my mind? What do you think?
Well, I think, look, the question is how quickly could the economy bounce back? And a lot of that, too, if he does want to pull that Band-Aid off and assume how far have we gone, you know, how far has the situation deteriorated with the Chinese, and what is business doing to look for some kind of predictability? If you were thinking long term, Mexico would be kind of the natural place where you would turn to build stronger economic ties at a time when you're trying to reduce your reliance on Chinese manufacturing. I think part of it, too, is we're going to look at the data, and already you said Mexico was the third. I've talked to some trade experts who believe now, if you really parse the numbers, they're our biggest trading partner. So that impact can't be understated. Look, if he's trying to kind of, you know, juice or game out the economy in that manner, perhaps he's crazy as a fox. I think there's other people who are going to be even more conspiratorial and say, look, if he's trying to force interest rates down, let's get a look at his tax returns and balance sheet to see actually how much he benefits from having to owe his lenders less at a lower interest rate.
Right. Okay, Dan, we're coming to the end of this segment very, very quickly. And I mean, we're out of time, but tell me why in God's name are we seeing bipartisan support going after the tech companies on antitrust? Where is the is this just political gain, and can they actually do anything? Because they are, as we saw yesterday, right on the precipice of killing the golden goose that was driving this market forward.
Yes, I think it's the challenge is that, look, tech has become such a major influence in our everyday lives. The role that Facebook and social media played in the 2016 election has politicians looking for some kind of scapegoat in terms of how much influence moves through these networks. I think we also see the challenge that tech is now facing is that even though it's created a lot of wealth, it hasn't created as many good-paying jobs as other industries have. So it lacks a natural constituency to be there to defend it on the Hill.
I'd probably argue about the good-paying jobs. There are a lot of good-paying jobs in tech and certainly in a lot of these companies. But for another Farcast, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, thank you so much for being with us. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be right back with the great Les Munson on the Farcast. Stay with us.
You're listening to Farcast.
Do you have an upcoming function and need a dynamic speaker to engage your audience? You've enjoyed listening to the Farcast, so why not invite Michael Farr to speak at your next event? In addition to hosting the Farcast and serving as president of the advisory firm Farr, Miller & Washington, Michael is the longest-serving paid contributor to CNBC.
He is recognized by audiences, and his presentations on the economic outlook are always well received. Michael has recently appeared at such venues as the Economic Club of Memphis, the University of Delaware, Matheson Financial Conference, and the YPO-WPO Economic Summit. Add your event to the growing list of organizations who have been informed and captivated by Michael's insights. For more information or to book Michael for an upcoming event, please email me, Harry Jennings, at hjennings@farmiller.com or call me at 202-530-5608.
You're listening to Farcast. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks again for joining us this week. We're always so happy and privileged to have you with us on the Farcast. Terrific recording, terrific evening in session tonight. Jim Murillo from the floor of the Chicago Exchange, Dan Mahaffey, as we're trying to sort out Mexico. And remember, on the Farcast, we talk about Wall Street, Washington, and the world, and how all of this is going to affect Wall Street and investors. And in Washington, you know, we try to figure out who are the best people we can talk to, and absolutely one of the best and a Farcast favorite for so many listeners who send us notes, Lester Munson, principal at the International BGR Group, a leading government relations firm in Washington, D.C. He's adjunct faculty at Johns Hopkins University, visiting fellow at George Mason's National Security Institute. It goes on and on. You see him on TV. You've heard him here. Lots of fabulous experience. Welcome back, Les. We're so glad to have you back on the Farcast.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be back.
Well, lots going on, certainly, this week. Markets have been very volatile, very, very volatile. Stocks, Dow Jones Industrial Average today closing up over 500 points, the NASDAQ almost 200 points. It's just been remarkable. And as all of this is happening, of course, we've seen the yield on the 10-year Treasury move lower and lower over the past several days, now down to 212 on the 10-year Treasury. So interest rates are very low. Fed Chairman Powell said that seemed to be the biggest catalyst today, suggesting that they would be supportive of continuing this expansion in the economy. Everybody liked to hear that the Fed was behind the stock market and it started to move up. So not only do we have the Fed kind of trying to help things, we've got in Washington, senators, we were just saying to Dan Mahaffey, the senators have warned the White House that they have the votes now to overturn any sort of tariff imposed on Mexico based on immigration, and they have the additional votes necessary to override the veto. So having actually worked in the White House and having all of this wonderful experience, tell us what we should make of that vote. Tell us what you think about the president's visit even today in England, his meetings with the ceremonial meetings, but also his meetings with Theresa May and what new leadership might mean in England. And then where are we with China? Is it just stalled, dead in the water? So start anywhere you like. I know that's just a few light topics.
We could easily cover this in 10 minutes.
Easily no in problem. 10 minutes.
So I think there's a lot of fascinating things going on the tariff question, and you framed it nicely. I don't think that the markets are showing a lot of are demonstrating strength because they believe Congress is going to do the right thing. I think what is what I suspect is the more realistic scenario is that tariffs, at least as they've been used by this administration, by President Trump, were initially weaponized by him and now have been normalized. And I think there's a sense that while no one wants to see tariffs imposed, there is no longer the fear that it's going to turn into a trade war and destroy the economy.
Do you think they have been normalized? They can block him, but what if he says starting immediately, we're going to go to a 10% or 25% tariff on steel the way he has in the past? Isn't Congress going to be playing catch up? I mean, or can he keep these things weaponized?
I think one of the things that's gone unreported here is that the president actually kind of painted himself into a corner on tariffs and on Mexico and on the border, and on the border in particular. It was the main theme of his campaign. We're going to build this big, beautiful wall. He hasn't done that, at least not very well so far.
And he is starting to get a ton of criticism from the right in the form of radio talk show hosts. Even the Dennis Miller podcast has gone after him for not being tough enough on the border.
Does anybody listen to Dennis Miller? I think they only listen to the Farcast. I don't know. But
well, the Farcast is much more important.
Much more important.
That first.
Well, thoughtful.
Much
anyway.
More important. A better program for sure. Even and funnier. Than
much
funnier.
Take that,
but,
Miller.
But the president's really under a lot of pressure to get results on the border. So his favorite tool, just in general, is the tariff. He's now merged the two. He's starting off a little mouth. He's given himself some real wiggle room here so that his goals are not super well defined. Folks are already talking. As he said today, Mexico called and they want to meet. I think this is working pretty well for him right now. He likes to be on the high wire act. This is a high wire act.
Yep.
He can't take it too far, but it's a pretty good show while it goes on.
Yep. What did PJ O'Rourke say? Giving money and power to Congress is like giving a fifth of whiskey and the car keys to a teenage boy. It kind of feels that way, doesn't it? PJ O'Rourke, one of the funniest, best writers I know, and a very dear friend, of course. So, Les, we kind of see what's going on, and the difference in 24 hours to me is remarkable from what markets were thinking yesterday as they were selling off versus where we are today, that it may not happen, that the Fed's going to be supportive, and phew, here we had this sort of big blow-up threat to the economy, to everything, stocks start to crumple, and then, well, maybe it's not a problem. I mean, it seems so schizophrenic. I mean, for responsible people and, billions and trillions of dollars moving, it just seems odd to me.
I think it's in part the underlying strength of the economy. We've got peace and prosperity in spades. And while we've got a bit of a showman as our chief executive in the government, overall, the situation for the U.S. economy really could not be better. There's no peer threat immediately. China, maybe in a couple of decades, could present that for us. Europe is not antagonistic to the United States. Iran is a regional power at best. You cannot underestimate the very favorable conditions for the United States right now.
So I couldn't agree with you more. Now, I did mention with Dan Mahaffey that we are seeing slowing growth coming into the fall in particular, and that's not been helped by the lack of resolution with the Chinese tariff trade dispute. But at least there we're tariffing trade, and when we're discussing trade, it seems more reasonable to me, but that's just far weighing in. Are we going to make any, do you see any progress coming out of China? And then let's circle back to Great Britain.
Well, I think the negotiations between the Trump administration and the Xi administration in Beijing are a little more straightforward. It is ostensibly about economic issues on both sides. It is complicated by this Huawei factor. Is that going to be a chit in negotiations? If it is, that's very bad for President Trump. He, again, has a lot more pressure on him from the right than people realize, and, in fact, from Democrats in Congress. The smart members of Congress, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, are looking very closely at these negotiations. They are setting themselves up to be critics of the deal as it's being negotiated right now, if it is too weak. So the president's under a lot of pressure to deliver a very good agreement with China. Frankly, I don't see how that's going to happen in the next year or so. I don't think we're going to get a deal before the election. They're too far apart, and
right,
there's too much pressure on the president to get a very good deal.
Okay. So that pressure, economic pressure, as we try to interpret Washington for Wall Street and investors, that pressure doesn't look like it's going to subside, according to Les Munson, even before the election. So that's going to remain with us. And we will be, even though it's a good economy, it's going to be a slow growth economy. You agree with that, Les?
Yeah, I think that's true. And there's real skepticism now in Congress, and it's largely because of lobbying by the business community of the Chinese economy, of the Chinese government, of Chinese relations with the United States. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. The business community was very much for engagement with China.
Yeah.
Now it is for punishing China. You've got concerns on any number of issues, from IP to other things. And Congress is hyper-aware of those and is going to reflect that concern.
Everybody seems to agree. I wrote yesterday that, oddly, Republicans, Democrats, and even economists all seem to agree that China has to be curtailed, and that they've been naughty, and that needs to stop somehow. So odd that everybody agrees on it. We'll see if they can actually get anything done. In our last 2 minutes, let's talk about what's going on over in Great Britain. Theresa May is out. We still don't know what's happening with Brexit. The president has been endorsing candidates. Mr. Johnson may be the new prime minister. We'll see. Give us your read on what's going on in Britain, and what effect did the president just have or not have?
Well, there's a huge opportunity for the next prime minister of Great Britain to really make a difference. And it's going to be a Tory prime minister. It's going to be conservative. The socialist leader, the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, is unacceptable to way too many people. He's got anti-Semitic issues. He's got anti-American issues. So there's a real opportunity for the next Tory leader to take that dissatisfaction with Labour and the fact that people are exhausted by this Brexit battle and are probably going to be a little more flexible on a solution, whether it's a second referendum, whether it's new negotiations with Europe, highly unlikely, or whether it's a hard exit from the EU. The next prime minister will have a lot more forgiveness from the populace for the approach that he or she is going to take. Looks like Boris Johnson's the leading candidate. He's eccentric. The British like eccentric politicians. He's got a great haircut. He's an excellent composer of limericks. He can do it on the fly. He wins awards for it.
Really?
What Americans may not appreciate is he was born in New York City, but he went to Eton. He went to Oxford. He's a one percenter from Great Britain. A little bit aristocratic. He's a descendant, I think, of King George II.
Dear Lord.
He's got a lot of things going for him. He's a very interesting candidate.
What does he do with Brexit?
President Trump. Sorry?
What does he do with Brexit?
He has set it up where he can manage a hard exit from the EU, which will be very painful and awkward and expensive and is going to have a lot of bad news attached to it. But he's already talking about a hard exit if a new agreement can't be reached by October. He's setting that up for his and if he wins this vote, if he's got a mandate to do that, it's going to be a little bit easier for him than it was for Theresa May to manage anything close to that. So
he's
got a lot going for him going into if in fact he's the next prime minister, he's going to have a lot more going for him than Theresa May did.
Okay. Les, I can't believe it, but we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for being with us. I've always learned so much. I'm going to do it, though. Are you ready? This is one of my favorite Irish ones. There once was a girl from Donegal who wore a newspaper dress to the ball. By chance, her attire did somehow catch fire and burned her front page, Spartan section and all. All right. That's
the accent that makes it funny.
It may be the only clean limerick I know. In fact, I'm sure it is. Les Munson is a principal at BGR Group, leading government relations firm in Washington, D.C., one of the smartest guys I know, also one of the nicest guys I know. Thank you so much, Les, for being with us. We appreciate it a great deal. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast. Thank you for joining us, for having us in your earbuds, living rooms, automobiles, walking out on the trail. Wherever you are, we really do are grateful that you take us with you. We'll be back next week with another great Farcast in Washington, D.C. Grateful as ever, I'm Michael Farr.
Thank you for listening to this week's Farcast. We hope you enjoy the show just as much as we enjoy making it for you. Please subscribe and share with a friend. The Farcast is available for free on Apple Podcast and all major podcast platforms. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings, and our production engineer is Claude Jennings. We love hearing from our listeners. Let us know what you liked, what questions you have, and what topics you'd like to hear in coming weeks. You can reach out to us at farcast@farmiller.com. We would like to remind you that if you think you have heard a recommendation to buy or sell any security here on the Farcast, you haven't. The Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. Before you make any investment decision, we strongly recommend you consult with a financial professional to determine what may be best for your individual needs and your goals. And if we can be of assistance at Farm Miller in Washington, please reach out to us at invest@farmmiller.com. Every week, we bring you the experts and insiders to give you a look at the forces that shape our world, the economy, and the investing landscape. Go beyond the headlines with the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world.